Welcome to the Nerd Party.
Hello and welcome to the A24 project here on the Nerd Party, the only podcast that takes you to the back catalogue of A24, two films every week, along with the interviews from the talent behind those movies. I guess it's the right time to say Happy New Year and welcome to the first episode of 2020. Ooh, 2020 vision there. I hope you all got some A24 merch under the tree, although let's face it, if you did want some A24 shop merchandise for Christmas, you probably would have had to buy it yourself, otherwise it would have sold out immediately. So there we go. On today's episode, we are taking a look at Lean on Pete and Backstabbing for Beginners. I'm your co-host Dallas King, and with me as always is Lee Hutchison. How are you this week and this year?
Yeah, really good. We're in the year of the first cow, so yeah, I'm excited to dive into 2020.
Absolutely. And before we dive in properly, of course, we always have a little bit of A24-hour news. And this is the news. Of course, disclaimer, full disclaimer, we're actually recording this before Christmas. So therefore, you know, if anything happens between Christmas and New Year, as A24 are prone to do, they're always going to announce a couple of things. You know, we'll miss out. But, you know, what we do have is that Uncut Gems has just been released and has scored one of the highest per screen averages of the year from a limited release. It opened on 5 screens in New York and LA to $525,498 for a $105,100 per screen average. And the main reason it is big news is that it is a record for A24, beating their Moonlight opening from 2016, and it's currently the second best opening, limited opening of 2019 behind the universally praised Parasite. So does this bode well for Uncut Gems going on wide release?
I would hope so, yes. We've got the UK release date, which is wonderful now as well. I can't wait for that. So yeah, I'm so excited to see this one again. It's when we kind of saw it, it was like late at night, we were buzzed. I think we were probably at one point, and I think we both looked at our heart monitors on our phones and stuff after the film. So I think we were definitely stressed, but I'm really excited to dive back into it again. It's one of these sorts of frustrating ones when you see sometimes a film at a festival, you think, oh my God, I love that, I would like to see it again. And then you're sort of faced with, well, it could actually be 4 or 5 months before you see it again. And then you get all the other people getting to see it like on wide release, etc. in America. And you think, oh, I just want more Uncut Gems. I want to get back into that discourse. I want to see it again to see how I felt about this certain moment on repeat viewing. And do I really want to buy a Boston Celtics jersey, etc. So yeah, I'm really happy for the film and can't wait to be part of it again.
Boston Celtics jersey. Knicks rule. I'm the Knicks. I'm a New York guy. It's actually amazing that actually Uncut Gems is directed by two New Yorkers and they basically are praising a Boston Celtics player. It's bizarre, but you know, that's the world of movies, isn't it? So will you be waiting to see it on the big screen again rather than waiting for Netflix? You want that big screen experience and seeing everyone in the screen getting universally tense at the same time.
Do people overpay for A24 items in the shop? Yes, yeah. So I'll be seeing it in the cinema opening weekend. I think the problem potentially could be that I think the dates are going to start coming out soon for films, cinemas in Edinburgh. I'm not too sure because I think the film house might be showing it from the 17th, last I heard. So I kind of have to rely maybe on the View Cinema or something like that to maybe show it. So I might have to have an extra wait on top of that. So could be stressful times, Dallas, stressful times.
Stressful times, yeah. Because obviously you won't be able to see it at Cineworld or a picture house because it has a limited theatrical window because if people aren't aware yet, it has been pretty much confirmed that it will have a international Netflix release on January the 31st. Certainly confirmed for Australian stuff at this point, and with the fact that it's been released in the UK cinemas on the 10th of January, kind of ties up with the 31st of January, where everyone will be able to see it. Whether it will have the same sort of wide impact that Marriage Story has managed to have, certainly in terms of memes, we will have to see. But another place that Uncut Gems is doing quite well is the awards circuit. Critics' Choice nominations were announced this week and we're starting to see the lay of the land in terms of A24 films and their chances for the big one. They're initially looking to push 5 films this awards season: The Farewell, Midsummer, Waves, The Lighthouse, and Uncut Gems. But it would now appear that there's pretty much 2 frontrunners that A24 will probably focus on to repeat their 2017 success with Moonlight, hopefully. So Uncut Gems got Best Picture, Best Actor, Best Director, and Best Editing nominations. The Farewell got Best Actress, Best Supporting Actress, Best Original Screenplay, and Best Comedy nominations. A couple of smaller nominations for The Lighthouse, with Best Supporting Actor for Willem Dafoe and Cinematography. Yes, I approve. And then Midsummer got Best Sci-Fi or Horror. Sadly, no Florence Pugh for Best Actress there. But also in the Golden Globes, A Farewell got nominated for Best Actress in a Comedy or Musical and Best Foreign Film, which is an odd one because it's an American film by A24, but because apparently it has over 50% of its language in a foreign language, it is somehow counted as Best Foreign Film at the Golden Globes. Who knows with the Golden Globes. So as we sort of head towards, we're now in the new year, because technically we're in January now, I guess, as this goes out. Do you think that Uncut Gems and The Farewell will receive the biggest push from A24 as we head towards the Oscars?
Yeah, I get the feeling, sort of. Unfortunately, Waves and The Lighthouse didn't get the biggest wide push and stuff. On the end, I know they had sort of a limited rollout. I think the limited rollout hit went quite well, but not perhaps enough to kind of get the bigger rollout sort of in America. I personally, I said it a wee while ago after the London, I thought Waves probably stood the best chance at the Oscars. It kind of feels like maybe it's not getting that momentum to maybe carry it through at the moment, which is really frustrating. So I kind of feel it's probably with The Farewell and Uncut Gems to kind of carry through. And that's such a shame that some other films aren't going to be kind of carried along for the ride, sadly.
Yeah, I know. And what do you make of Adam Sandler's threat that if he doesn't get a Best Actor nomination at the Oscars, he's going to make a film for Netflix that is so bad it'll make Jack and Jill look like a masterpiece?
I think I've not seen much of his Netflix movies, but I think the appropriate answer would be, if someone went, he's going to make a movie so bad, etc., would be, again. But I really hope, I have a feeling he's going to get nominated. I genuinely do.
Yeah, I think I'm looking forward to actually seeing when this finally drops on Netflix and everyone who is a fan of Adam Sandler films such as Murder Mystery, Jack and Jill, and his other sort of range of Netflix director, Netflix video movies, when they just put Uncut Gems on thinking it'll be another sort of Billy Madison, Happy Gilmore comedy, and are then just their minds explode with what's going on. I would really actually like to sit and watch people do that and find out what they make of it, because I think it would be quite a shock, an adrenaline shock to the system anyway. But enough about Uncut Gems, because we're going to discuss it on a later episode, and you know, if it eventually does win some awards on A24 Hour News later on as well. But the first film up for discussion today is Lean on Pete, and this is written and directed by Andrew Hay, who has directed 45 Years and Weekend, and is based on the novel by Willie Vlotten. The film follows 15-year-old Charlie Thompson, a teen living with his single father, who finds work caring for an aging racehorse named Lean on Pete. When he learns that Pete is bound for the slaughterhouse, the two embark on an odyssey across the new American frontier in a search for a place called home. This film stars Charlie Plummer, Steve Buscemi, Chloe Sevigny, Steve Zahn, and Travis Fimmel. So, Lee, is this a first-time watch for you for Lean on Pete? What did you know about it going in, and what were your initial thoughts?
Yeah, I caught this one at the tail end of last year. It was kind of quite an acclaimed movie. It was released by Curzon here in the UK, so I picked it up for about £6 or something like that on Blu-ray. So yeah, I was really keen to check this one out. I didn't know much going in. I sort of knew it as, oh, it's that movie about the horse and the horse kind of owner. But I think it was one of these ones, I think we're going to discuss it when it gets to the Children Act probably later in this year, that the two films sort of kind of lined up in a way where it was almost like The Bug's Life and Armageddon for these films, that with Children Act there was this great British film called Apostasy that came out where it was like both looked at sort of the Jehovah's Witness religion, which was really interesting. And then this film kind of matched up similar in the same year as The Rider. So that one was directed by Chloe Zehu, who's going to go on to direct a Marvel movie this year. I thought it was one of the most underrated films of last year too. So But I kind of came into seeing Lean on Pete after seeing The Rider, which left such a strong impression on me. You know, kind of different films, but really ultimately about a young man's relationship with a horse. And Lean on Pete sort of struggled a bit in sort of comparison because, you know, the world isn't big enough for two films about horses and young people. And I enjoyed it. It felt maybe it was a bit more focused on a younger audience in a way. I didn't really kind of get emotionally invested in this film as much as I kind of hoped to. It's a really well-made film. I think Andrew Haig has kind of a lot to say, you know, for an English director, you know, kind of predominantly kind of worked in that sort of field. I think he shoots America really well. I like sort of the journey they go on. It's just ultimately I maybe saw a better horse film in 2018, and I felt sort of a bit unlucky for Lean on Pete.
Yeah, no, it was a bit of a nearly ran, was it, for you? I mean, I have to admit that I watched this for the first time sort of last week and didn't really know much about it. I knew it was about a kid and a horse and they go on an adventure. And I don't know, I hadn't really seen any trailers for it. And I just had this idea in my head of what the film was going to be. And then I think I got something slightly different. And for one reason or another, I mean, I can see that it's a well-made film, it's well put together, but it just didn't work for me at all. I just couldn't get engaged with it at all. I don't know what it was. It was just, there was just some sort of disconnect. I don't know whether it was the mood that I was in or what, but I just didn't click with anything to do with this film. I was, perhaps part of it was, you know, because I'd built up in my mind it was going to be a different type of film, but I think anyone going for the kid sort of bonding with a horse, this sort of racetrack horse, and then going on this adventure might end up be slightly disappointed in what they actually get, because it's actually more of a sort of coming of age story from the kid's point of view, and the horse is almost like a MacGuffin or a Deus Ex Machina to get him moving on the road, on the frontier, to as he tries to cross America to go and see his aunt. And potentially find a new place called home and stuff like that. So I'm not sure if what you felt about that aspect, where it seemed to be more about, okay, because I mean, I don't know if we go into spoilers or not at one point, but I mean, it was a felt very much like a, one of the, in some aspects, archetypical American road movie where, you know, this person's going from place to place and you meet all these different little characters and he has wee interactions with them. But I didn't feel that really many of them, apart from maybe sort of the Steve Zahn one towards the end, added really anything to his character or gave him any big sort of life lessons. The sort of stopping off with the kids playing video games and stuff like that. Or at one point it maybe looked like he might have had a bit of a romance with one of the girls or something, but nothing ever really came to anything. And I found it maybe a bit frustrating that perhaps it was just me with Unconscious Bias expecting one type of film, and when I didn't get it and I got a different type of film that I wasn't expecting, I just didn't manage to click with it perhaps.
I think it kind of peaks quite early in a way that I really enjoy, sort of when Charlie's interacting with Steve Buscemi's Del Montgomery, the horse trainer, and Chloe Savannah as the jockey. I really enjoyed sort of that part and kind of watching them together as a team, and then sort of when he goes off on his own, I just didn't find Charlie engaging enough. Like, there wasn't sort of I didn't feel sort of the connection necessarily between him and the horse that I did with perhaps, say, The Rider, with the young gentleman in that one. I just sort of liked, you know, the pairing, this group of three, how they all interacted and sort of that relationship, and sort of it's got this horse in, you know, the center of it. I just think when the, you know, when you lose sort of people like Chloe and Steve, it kind of, the film suffers for it, and I just kind of wished we'd were able to kind of stay with them just a bit longer.
Yeah, no, I think that's a good point. I think it's because, yeah, the film almost sort of splits in two, because, you know, you do have, you know, the character of Charlie, who sort of lives with his, you know, father, who is clearly a bit of an alcoholic, has anger management issues, is sort of womanizing and stuff like that. Doesn't seem to, he cares for his son, but doesn't seem to have much time for him. And then he almost finds a sort of other sort of fatherly figure in Dale, played by Steve Buscemi, is this sort of irritable, sort of wisecracking sort of horse owner and stuff like that. So you could see if it had sort of become about him developing a bond with him and going on the road with him, I think that might have made a potentially more interesting film. I think it's the fact that he wants to save this horse, and so he steals the horse and drives off into the sunset, but then doesn't really sort of have a plan and stuff like that. And I don't know, I mean, because this is one of Charlie Plummer's sort of first roles, and apparently, you know, he's well university plays, but I just didn't sort of feel that engaged with him. It's a bit of a sort of almost sort of a blank sort of canvas. He's very sort of stoic and internal, and I'm not sure if that really worked for what was necessary, especially when, you know, for the second half of the film, he's playing opposite a horse who can't really give much back. You need perhaps a different type of personality to bounce off a horse, which is a sentence I don't think I would have thought I would have said on the A24 project or any other podcast, really, when talking about a film.
No. I think you're pretty spot on there.
Okay, so, I mean, it's been out for a couple of years, so, I mean, we could potentially sort of head into the sort of spoiler territory for this. Were you expecting the sort of third act sort of twist where Lean on Pete meets his end, not in the way that was initially intended, perhaps?
I quite like that, to be honest. I think kind of watching that, I was kind of happy to... I think that middle is a bit of a sag, really. And I liked where I was like, oh, they've gone there. And I like it. It's a very traumatic way to kill off, you know, the titular character, really.
It's the titular role.
Exactly. I like that. Then that it was nice to have a bit of a surprise element in the film. Whether that says that I am a perverted animal hater, I'll leave that to the audience to decide. But I thought that was a really good twist, to be honest. What about for yourself?
I mean, it sort of came out of nowhere, and I think it was just because of the kind of mood that I was in, but I have to say that I did let out a laugh when it happened. It reminded me of the moment in Judy and Punch where there's a shocking moment, but it is played for laughs. And it got laughs at the screening that we saw in at London Film Festival. But this, I don't think, was meant for laughs, but I ended up laughing at it. But, I mean, it certainly kicked the film back into gear for the third act and gave Charlie more to work with and more of a drive and purpose, you know, and more to work with in terms of the loss that he suffers and like that, because he suffers another loss because he loses his father sort of at the end of the first act, and that's the one of the driving points that pushes him on this journey in the first place. So he keeps losing those closest to him, and he's just really searching for love and a home. So I think it was a shocking twist, but I think it was well handled after the fact. It was just the initial moment I did let out an unexpected laugh. So I feel bad about that.
Sometimes I think it's an uncomfortableness or a surprise. I've been in films before where something genuinely shocking and vile has happened and my reaction was like, oh, okay. You know, I think of something like Sicario when he just like caps the entire family in front of him. I'm like, okay, I will go along with that.
So in terms of, like you said, you like the direction of Andrew Hay in terms of his bringing, you know, he's sort of done British films before, but sort of his version of the American new frontier, I guess. You know, there was some lovely sort of cinematography with the sort of setting suns that actually reminds me of the sort of Sicario sunsets and stuff that Roger Deakins was able to do. So, I mean, were you impressed with his work on this, and do you like his other films?
Yeah, I quite like, I think, was it 45 Years was a real highlight for me. I've unfortunately never seen, what's it called, Weekend? Was that
yeah,
the film that he'd done?
Yeah, fantastic. It was, I think it's 2011. It was one of the films that it was just randomly on at the Belmont one weekend, and I saw it, and it's, you know, this story of it's a gay love story, but just set over one weekend, hence why Weekend. I mean, I'm assuming that 45 Years is then also set over 45 years. No, it starts off after 45 years, but he seems to be liking playing with time and stuff like that. But I thought he has a very sort of naturalistic and sort of accessible way into stories. I think he's a director with real talent, and I'm looking forward to seeing what he can do in the future, I think.
And I think what I quite liked about it as well was that it was quite pleasant to watch a kind of another A24 film that kind of takes in sort of that overlooked sort of the flyover states, as they call them. You know, I think, you know, Lean on Pete would make a bit of an A24 series with something like American Honey, you know, kind of maybe Slow West to an extent. You know, there's kind of a few other movies in there where I would sort of throw in sort of, just kind of going through the list just now. Yeah, and there seems to be sort of that, you know, kind of never going back. The Florida Project, you know, even though some of these states are a bit more well known than others, sort of showcasing the life that are in some of these places as well, you know, not just the most popular kind of East Coast, West Coast kind of spots. I think A24 have been really good at that, and I think that's probably what maybe attracted them to Lean on Pete.
There's an idea. Maybe we should draw up a map of the United States and then start marking off which states A24 films have visited, and then see if we can eventually get all sort of 52 states or something like that. It could be a fun game, you know, like one of those posters you get where you scratch off all the, you know, the films that you've watched until you make up the entire map or something like that. We could do that. It could be, we could put it on the, we could pitch it to the A24 shop. There's an idea. Your A24 map,
yeah,
of America.
Yeah, absolutely, come
in. Okay, so do you have any sort of final thoughts on Lean on Pete?
If you like Lean on Pete, check out The Rider. So I would, that would be my recommendation. I'm really sorry to Lean on Pete, but yeah, I would encourage you to make it a double bill and let me know what you think of the 2018 Horse.
Absolutely. The Rider is a film which I've always heard amazing things about, but just for one reason or another, I've never actually seen it yet. So I'm going to I'm making a note on my notes for the podcast to basically add it to my watch list or my iTunes list or something like that, and get that watched ASAP, because it will also then add into my 52 films by women total for the year as well, which you can check out on Filibuster, where we discuss how the project went so far this year. So there you go, cross promotion as always. But the next film, second film of today's episode, is going to be Backstabbing for Beginners, written and directed by Per Fly. This is based on the book by Michael Susan about the real-life scandal about corruption in the UN Oil for Food programme. And this stars Theo James and Sir Ben Kingsley. Obviously, not Ben Kingsley, Sir Ben Kingsley, always. So, yeah, Lee, were you familiar with this film? Because, like, this was one which I certainly had to get from the US iTunes store, and it's certainly not one that I'd heard of before in terms of making its way over to UK cinemas. So did you manage to find it easily enough, and what were your initial thoughts?
Yeah, this was one I had to get. I took a Now TV 1 week deal out for, so I watched this one and The Last Movie Star on that using my 1 week free trial. So yeah, it was a bit of a struggle to find this one. And I know I mentioned sort of in the last film with Lean on Pete that it put me in the mood to watch another film, which was The Rider, which I thought was a superior film. Watching Backstabbing for Beginners made me want to watch nearly any other film that we've reviewed on sort of the A24 project. This was the 90th A24 film that I have seen, and it was unfortunately a bit of a disappointing kind of landmark. I really like political kind of thrillers where it's people in rooms talking about bureaucracy and kind of red tape. I find that kind of stuff really exciting. With Backstabbing for Beginners, I never once felt invested in sort of this film, this plot, and I really struggle. This feels like such an anomaly in sort of the A24 filmography. I'm kind of a bit curious about why they picked this one. I can't see how this fits in at all with our filmography. Even some of the films that we haven't been fans of in the past, whether it's like Revenge of the Green Dragons or Cut Bank, for example, you know, you think, I can get what they're going for. It's maybe something from a unique point of view. It's maybe something that's failed a bit in the execution. It's got some great acting. With this, it was just like, how has this ended up in here? And I wonder if anyone has ever bought the Backstabbing for Beginners mug from the A24 shop.
Do you want to try and submit a Freedom of Information request to A24 shop and find out the sales of the mugs, to find out what their most popular and least popular films are? I don't know if the Freedom of Information Act requests work the same way in America as they do over here in the UK, but yeah, it's maybe an idea. I agree with you pretty much wholeheartedly on this film. Similar to your thing about having watched The Rider and then Lean on Pete at some other time, I was just coming off basically watching The Report by Adam Driver, with it starring Adam Driver in it, on Amazon Prime. And that was a far superior political thriller, which, you know, this one ventures out more outside into outside of rooms, because the report is almost contained entirely in offices and stuff like that. This is, film is, you know, goes over to Iraq and Baghdad and stuff like this, but it just, for once, it never, I mean, it's apparently based on a true story, but feels 100% like someone has written a generic political thriller using basically, like, you know, one of those apps where you just input the scripts for political thrillers and then it creates its own one based on the stuff that's come before, because all the sort of story beats that you would expect, like, oh, the boss that is actually in on it, you know, oh, this woman who is trying to give him information but she can't really be trusted, but then they end up falling in love and he tries to get her out but then she might double cross him and stuff like this, and it's just like, I've sort of seen it all before, and the fact it's apparently based on a true story is almost slightly unbelievable, because it seems like it's been souped up to try and become a much more exciting sort of thrill, but it really is quite dull. And I think one of the biggest problems is, and this sort of, whenever this appears in a film which I'm not enjoying, I always think back to this quote from Adaptation from 2000, where Charlie Kaufman goes to a screenwriting workshop with Robert McKee, who's played by Brian Cox, and he's sort of internally sort of thinking in his head about, you know, what if this thing's no good, how am I going to be able to do this? And it cuts back to Robert McKee going, God help you if you use voiceover in your work, my friend. God help you. It's flaccid, sloppy writing. Any idiot can come up with a voiceover narration to emphasize the thoughts of a character. And that's what I thought of when this, because basically everything that happens in the film, Theo James's lead character has to sort of say why it's happening or who it's happening to and stuff like that. And surely there are more interesting and effective ways and be able to tell a story. I can understand it's probably from an autobiography or something like that, but it basically seems like they've just almost cut and pasted the things that he said on top of the scenes in order to show what's actually happening, where it's like we're too dumb to be able to pick up the nuances of the plot and stuff like that. We wouldn't have been able to, oh gosh, how am I ever going to figure out that Ben Kingsley might actually be a bad guy? Oh no, wait, he's paid by Ben Kingsley, where he's slightly doing his sexy beast I'm a bad guy act. I mean,
yeah, I was kind of familiar with the kind of the guy who was the subject of the film, Michael Susson. He's on, like, I Really Like American Politics, and he regularly appears on a podcast I listen to called Morning Joe. Other podcasts are available, it seems. And when I sort of was watching this, I was like, he does sound familiar. And then I looked it up and there he was. He was sort of the guy that I see on MSNBC and some news channels just chatting about politics and Donald Trump, etc., etc. So yeah, that was kind of a added something to my podcast listening. Like, oh, I wonder if one day there'll be a film about us and someone will go, wait, this really poor, mediocre film's about those two guys that have a podcast I listen to. So hopefully the film about our life is a bit more exciting than his. But yeah, it's just, I really don't get why A24, you know, obviously this is a DirecTV film, if that wasn't obvious at all. But yeah, I don't get why they invested in this one.
Yeah, I know. So if they were to do a film of the A24 project, who would you want to play you?
Well, I've been recently rewatching Ally McBeal recently. It's been a new addition to Amazon Prime. And in school, my nicknames would sometimes be The Biscuit, because I had bared a bit of a physical resemblance, maybe a little bit of a personality resemblance to John Cage from Ally McBeal, played by Peter MacNicol. So I think that would be the kind of cast person for me. Who would play you, Dallas?
I don't know. I think occasionally, sort of, I sort of glance myself in the mirror and I can see a sort of slight resemblance to Joseph Gordon-Levitt. But I think with my inability to grow a proper beard, I'd probably go Leonardo DiCaprio. So perhaps if I'm Leo, do you want to be, should we get Brad Pitt to play you? We can have like a repeat of Once Upon a Time in Hollywood.
Absolutely, yeah, I get to, you know, I think we'll definitely go from sort of scrawny white men to sex symbols, so that can always be a
absolutely
good thing.
We've just got to buff ourselves up in a similar way to Kumail Nanjiani, who's just done that for The Eternals as well. So that's that apparently, but I love the way that this has come out recently, and this is a complete sidetrack to the film which we were meant to have been talking about, but the fact that basically it's like, if you want to be able to work out and get buff, basically get hired in a Marvel movie and they'll basically pay you to eat well and train hard. So seeing how Kumail Nanjini's managed to buff up, I could only just imagine what killing of a sacred deer star Barry Keoghan is going to look like in a couple of weeks when he reveals how hard he's been working out. So if they do a sequel to Killing the Sacred Deer, then that could be quite interesting.
Yeah, that's certainly something to think about. And this is a testament to backstabbing exactly, for beginners, yeah, that we've gone so wild off track that we've cast ourselves as different actors. We've now gone on to start a chat about Marvel movies of all things. Sorry, Marty. So yeah, like, very damning for backstabbing for beginners.
Yeah, I mean, is it a bad film or is it just sort of a forgettable film? And is it because it's just so run-of-the-mill? Is that why you think it's so odd in its placement in the A24 catalogue? Because like you say, you know, we've watched some stinkers in our time that we haven't really liked, you know, say like Revenge of the Green Dragons and stuff. But they have potentially been for other audiences. You know, they've been trying to capture that sort of Chinese audience and stuff like that in American things like that. They do things which can potentially have very niche audiences that aren't really represented, and that's where they're going for with these films. Whereas this one seems very run-of-the-mill sort of cookie cutter political thriller, but they're not done very well. So I think it does stand out even more as a bit of an anomaly, that it's why it's there in the catalogue.
I think we are in that sort of this weird little phase at the moment. We sort of just finished, we sort of kickstarted 2018 last week with Vanishing of Sidney Hall, Last Movie Star, which we really didn't like, I think we'd be safe to say. You know, The Last Movie Star, much more so. Lean on Pete, okay, fine. Backstabbing for Beginners, not interested in almost even talking about. And then we kind of have the treat of First Reformed is up next, which is a hell of a treat. So, you know, we've been kind of spoiled a bit lately. I always think when we get to the tail end of the year for A24 releases, you know, we get into the really good stuff. And then at the beginning of the year, it's maybe not their best output, but we've got a hell of a treat to come, and it makes it feel worth it for, you know, coming and watching Backstabbing for Beginners on a Sunday afternoon and having to make up a thing.
Yeah, no, it does almost seem like we are in a bit of a end of the year holding pattern before getting to First Reform, which, you know, we have been effusive in our praise on in the past and on Filibuster as well. But, you know, they can't all be winners. They can't all be Moonlights and First Reforms, you know. I mean, if they were, then, you know, A24 would be untouchable, you know. But it's always a fascinating look in to find out, you know, because on the A24 group on Facebook, certainly, you know, just from glancing that every day, you know, there are certain films which always get mentioned, The Witch, is your Midsummers and Hereditaries and things like that. But, you know, and there seems to be this idea that that is all A24 are, but, you know, they have had other films out there, you know, they have taken risks here and there. Some gambles have worked, some have not worked, and this is probably one that hasn't worked. But, you know, they're still a young company, you know, they're only sort of like, you know, started distributing films, you know, sort of 6-7 years ago now. So, you know, they were in their infancy almost still at this point. You know, I think people still sort of would say that 2017 and 2019 are probably the best years overall in terms of quality for A24, and I think films like this in 2018 would basically sort of prove that point, that there's more duds in 2018 than there is maybe quality films at this point in time. You know, as we continue on through the project, maybe we'll see otherwise, but I think it's important to know that they will not knock it out of the park every time, but it's always fascinating to go and see these films. But I think there is a good rule of thumb that if you're in the UK and you're struggling to find a copy of a certain film that was distributed by A24 in America and you can't find it in the UK, there's potentially a reason for that, don't you think?
Yeah, I always say, have people in my letterbox watch this film, and before me and you saw it, it was blank from like the 250 odd people I follow on Letterbox, which is pretty damning for an A24 film, considering even something like Revenge of the Green Dragons had at least someone had watched it.
Yeah, well, I think that basically we'll draw a line under Backstabbing for Beginners there, and it brings us to the end of another edition of the A24 Project. And remember to check out next week's episode for Lee's exclusive interviews with the cast and crew of Waves. And then we're going to be back in 2 weeks' time because, well, somebody has to do something, and we're going to review First Reformed and how to talk about Girls at Parties. And we're going to be joined by the Nerd Parties and the Nerd Nuptials, Tristan Riddell, for that one. Are you looking forward to that, Lee?
Yeah, I'm really excited to dive into First Reformed. And kind of next week's an exciting one for me. We've been embargoed from sharing this until the UK release of Wave. So we have kind of a hell of a kind of pairing. We've got the writer-director, Trey Edward Schultz. Then we have Kelvin Harrison Jr. We have Taylor Russell, Renee Goldsberry, and Sterling K. Brown. And we're going to have a bit of an extract from a previous interview with Cresha Fairchild, where she talked about her experience on the shooting of Waves as well. So I think this might be our biggest interview episode yet.
I know, and I'm annoyed because I haven't seen Waves yet. So, but this is a spoiler-free one, is it? No, the first one isn't. The cast basically go into spoilers, don't they? So,
yeah, me and Trey Edward Schultz, we're sitting there chatting about spoiler culture and how it must be difficult to market this film without spoiling it. Then I'll sit down with the cast and they will just spoil things. So, you know, if you're going to listen to it, you can enjoy the Trey Edward Schultz one. And then if you've seen it, you can listen to the second part with the cast, where they have a good spoiler chat. And if you could visualize my face when the spoilers started spilling out, you would it would be quite the same.
Well, I look forward to imagining that and visualizing it. But then we'll see you in a couple of weeks for First Reformed and How to Talk to Girls at Parties. So see you then. Bye-bye.